Catholic Radio at the same time. The website can be found at AveMariaRadio.net.
Radio for Catholic and other Christians. This is 990 WDEO, Ypsilanti, Detroit, or on the internet at WDEO.net.
Hudson, welcome to Church and Culture. This show is devoted to exploring the interaction between our faith and our culture. Each week, I will talk with expert guests on topics ranging from literature, art, and music to politics, liturgy, spirituality, and education. Thank you for joining us. I've invited John Berenson back for another interview on Church and Culture because last week we had such fun with our discussion of Chopin's Nocturnes and what's considered to be one of the best, if not the best, recordings of the Nocturnes by the Czech pianist Ivan Moravec, who had died just a few days earlier. So I was inspired, and I hope you, the listener, will enjoy a follow-up with John Berenson on what is perhaps the most celebrated recording of Beethoven that's ever been made, and that's the Carlos Kleiber and Vienna Philharmonic recording of the Fifth and Seventh Symphonies from 1974 through 1976. John, welcome to Church and Culture. Do you think that's too high a praise for that recording?
Oh, no, Dylan. Thank you for welcoming me. I think that anybody starting from scratch who wants to learn, even from a standpoint of music appreciation, the first recording that I would recommend for them, if they have no other recordings at all, that this goes right to your first purchase, whether it's a download or the actual CD.
Or the vinyl.
Oh, the vinyl, that's true. I know you are back into vinyl.
Well, when this came out in 74, I bought it. I still have it. Still, yes. Sounds beautiful.
Yeah, and it's not only now gone through a number of remasterings. I can't tell a lot of the differences. I don't know if it's because I'm old, but I'm very happy with the one I have.
And what makes you so very happy with this recording, John?
It's timeless. As you say, it was recorded in the 70s. But one of the characteristics of Carlos Kleiber's conducting of anything, whether it's this or he's more primarily an opera conductor throughout his life, he only conducted about 90 concerts in his 74 years of
life. In his lifetime.
90-some in his lifetime.
The
year that Bernstein was with the New York Philharmonic there in the late 50s, he conducted 116 concerts in his first year. But now there, he conducted some 400 opera performances. So he was, though a lot of us know him more for something famous like this Beethoven, he, like a lot of European conductors, their apprenticeship goes to these small rural opera houses, and they worked their way up, and that was...
Well, his father was a great conductor.
Very great conductor, very great conductor, Erich Kleiber, and the story is, and it's probably true, Charles Barber, the one biographer, says this, and I remember talking to Barber about this. He lived under the shadow of his very stern father, Erich Kleiber, but his mother was Jewish, and when in the late 30s, and when Hitler and the war broke out, they moved to Argentina and for family safety, and he was there for a number of years. He was actually born Karl, K-A-R-L, the German, And when he moved to Argentina, it changed to Carlos.
Carlos, of course.
Yeah, to give it that South American, the Hispanic flavor. But then when he came back to Europe later as an adult, he became an Austrian citizen. But he had a lot of kind of cosmopolitan experience in the Americas as a young person. But his father was very, very reluctant. You shouldn't waste your life on conducting and on music. And
like I did, son.
Yes, right.
Right.
Yeah. And so his father was not a great encouragement. Carlos Kleiber actually had a degree in chemistry. That was his actual studies. But as a musician, he was a percussionist. I hadn't known that until recently. But what makes him extraordinary, and his father was kind of like this too, when they approach a score of whatever kind, it's when you hear it, it's as if it's being encountered by the musicians playing for their very first time in their life. I mean, many of us can remember times when we, as a child, for instance, first heard the 1812 Overture or something and the impact it had on us.
Right.
Instead of sitting on it. Well, when you hear Kleiber, no matter what he's playing, it sounds like it's the first time you've ever heard it and the musicians playing have ever heard it.
But he was a very rigorous in his preparation for these rehearsal time and so forth.
Right, the amount, as much as five times the amount of rehearsal demanded if he agreed to do a concert. Hence, he didn't play a lot of concerts because the unions and the musicians and the organizations couldn't stand it. But probably roughly five times the rehearsal time, five times more rehearsal time than an ordinary conductor. Also, he very frequently demanded all of the copies of the scores and in advance, and he would make markings
on every score for every player.
Right, you know, whether you were the bassoonist, the second bassoonist, or you were, you know, just somebody doing oompa for a little bit in the brass section, he went and he marked your score up based upon restudying even things that he knew. I mean, say something like the Beethoven, restudying it from scratch. He would try to find out anything new in the scholarly world that might be going on with new documents and sources. And if he did, he would go through and he would come hours in advance of rehearsal and mark everybody's score. And the musicians would show up and there they were on the stand with his hand markings on them. So he, in a sense, his passion was to literally go back to the burning bush of the composition where the composer was. That was his obsession.
Well, he was in his mid-30s when he made these two Beethoven symphony recordings with the Vienna Philharmonic. And
he died in 2004, and I think he was 74, I believe.
Didn't he basically stop performing for the last 10 years of his life completely?
Yes, he did. He became increasingly reclusive, and of course that became part of the legend. And so those who don't like his conducting, there are some in England.
What's the criticism of his conducting?
Well, that it's kind of like the same criticism of a Toscanini or a George Zell. One of the things the three of them shared was this razor-sharp precision, and some people find it almost harsh. I don't. I think it's, you know.
Well, I think once we play this first movement of this Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, I think we'll definitely get rid of that particular charge. Could you tell our listeners what to listen for in this extremely familiar passage from Beethoven? It's almost become kind of a cliche.
Starting with the first movement?
Oh, the Fifth Symphony, yes.
Yes. Well, you know, one of the popularizations that happened in the Beethoven Fifth was during World War II, when the BBC in England would begin and sign off a lot of their broadcasts to encourage Europeans with the opening signature for, you know, the three dots and a dash kind of thing. It's almost kind of mimic Morse.
Da-da-da-dum. Right.
V for victory. And that was done throughout the war by the BBC radio, and that's partly how it became popularized. It became in a sense, the Victory Symphony, almost an anthem for Europeans. That's one of the things. However, the opening, those opening lines, da 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 da, it actually there's a rest there. There's a ba 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 ba, and conductors apparently argue endlessly over what you're supposed to accent there. When you actually look at the score, there's an eighth note rest, and then the three dots and a dash. So it's not da 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 da. It's like ba 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 ba. And different conductors get fanatical on how they accent that. But in his lifetime, his biographer Schindler, who became sort of a popularizer of Beethoven and spun a lot of myths, claimed once that Beethoven said to him that this was the theme of destiny, the theme of one's
fate.
Right. Now, scholars have since then said that's a lot of Schindler's romantic spin, but people have never really gotten away from it. The fate theme. Did Beethoven say that? His buddy said he did. Who knows? But that's where it gets its reputation. Is that when you hear those notes, it has this human, universal human quality of this is your fate. You know, the bell tolls for you. That kind of thing.
Well, let's listen to it. This music was written between 1804 and 1808. That's very early in the Romantic period. And our listeners will know the music to begin with, but I think we should listen from what John just talked about, the precision, yet the utter spontaneity. Here's Carlos Kleiber conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. John, what strikes me in listening to that with you and all of our listeners is the contrast between this very assertive, romantic will, but it's the contrast is almost Mozartian.
When you hear the winds and the flutes come in, all of a sudden now you're in this kind of angelic, almost like you say, it's like a Mozartian sphere. And there is a kind of, when you hear a lot of Beethoven's work, especially his late work, when you hear trills and when you hear flutes and when you hear oboes, there is this kind of like holy, no, this is my language, this is kind of effusive language, there is this kind of Holy Spirit going through the breezes sort of quality that contrasts sharply with, you notice the way, especially with Kleiber does with it, almost a controlled frenzy. You know, it's like a thunderstorm. And in fact, the Sixth Symphony, which comes right after it,
it reminds me of the Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral.
Right. And the Pastoral Symphony has this famous storm. It's the only one that he agreed to actually attach a program to. He was not big for program music as they became in the Romantic era, where there's a storyline or imagery. However, he agreed to it with the Sixth Symphony, the Pastoral. So you get very much the sense of shepherds and fields and rolling meadows, and then there's a thunder, an approaching thunderstorm. a thunderstorm. And there is, by the way, a live recording by Kleiber that he just did not like, but is considered something of a gem. I have it, of him doing the sixth somewhere live. I forget. I think it's with the Bavarian State Radio Orchestra. And the storm scene in this live recording literally scares you, even as an adult. It reminds you of like when you were a child, you know, and you first got in storms and you had to call upon your parents. Well, when I listen to this Kleiber radio recording of the six, when he gets to the storm, he recreates the storm, and I actually sat there in my study and got scared.
A little kind of Mary Shelley and Byron, Lord Byron, on the lake on Lake Geneva. Then,
yeah, yeah, and but now what we just noticed in that excerpt you had with the way he does the rhythms and the accents. There is, on the one hand, an almost frenzy, but it never gets out of control. There's a explosive, I'm not going to use the word fire-breathing frenzy, but it's still under control. And that's the Kleiber genius.
In terms of Beethoven himself, as we get ready to play the second movement, which is lyrical and much much more gentle in style and spirit, what do you think is the overall theme of this symphony that our listeners can think about as they're listening?
It's quintessential Beethoven, and I've been thinking about this and anticipating our conversation, Jill. I would say it's the same as a lot of Beethoven, but especially here in Symphonies 5 and 7 and some other works. It's the great contrast between outbursts of joy arising out of some form of grief, or sadness, or struggle. Struggle, one of the reasons that Beethoven is universally appreciated across cultural lines is that he was the one that struggle, the human struggle in an authentic form, speaks from a lot of his works, even his happiest works. So
and this is because of his deafness?
Well, I think that, yeah, I mean, but even early on, even some of this, but it's gradually, as you're right, as the music, as he ages, it becomes less and less polite and somewhat Mozartian. But even in his earliest works and earliest symphonies, there are these explosions. And even before his deafness really descended upon him in a serious way, in fact, one of the reasons he was not always well received in Europe was that the music has this, what at the time was considered to be bombast. You know, it's a bombastic. Well, that's, of course, what's made him universally popular now. But what the Europeans at the time thought was something bombastic now is regarded as kind of the basic human struggle, the struggle against fate, destiny, death. You know, big dramatic, I would almost say Greek themes, almost like Greek tragedy themes that he's able to put in musical form. And then there's always the sense of emergence from the great struggle and some form of triumph that's cost a person dearly. Now that's getting kind of romantic in interpretation, but I think that's exactly where the heart of Beethoven's was possessed by this thing about fate and death and destiny and an ultimate joy.
I'm talking with John Berenson, who's a writer for the Christian Review, a retired Lutheran pastor, and for many years my mentor in classical music. Let's listen to the second movement now, the first part of it, conducted by Carlos Kleiber with the Vienna Philharmonic. Well, John, I said earlier that it was a gentler style and spirit second movement, but it gets into that military theme fairly quickly.
Yeah. You know, he wrote military band music. The reason I'm interested in band music is that our young adult son is a music teacher and a band director at a local high school, studied at the University of Indiana, and knows a lot about wind band music, which he has taught me, our youngest son, Matthew. And Beethoven was in the tradition of creating, as a lot of Germans and Austrians did then, military band marches. And in fact, I often hear military band music, march music, practical march music, when I hear sections of Beethoven. For instance, to this day, in Berlin, when the police do one of their annual parades, they parade to a Beethoven piece. I do it at night with torches, and it goes like this. It's wonderful. It's pure Beethoven.
That's pretty good, John.
And he wrote, there's a lot of that in the European tradition. And so there is, and that's where the emphasis in the flutes and all that comes from band music that he was involved with. Not a ton of it, but some memorable stuff.
Well, let's take a quick listen to opening of the third movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. John, it's interesting to me we're forced to just play a minute or two at the beginning of each movement, but there's a remarkable continuity between the movements, even though we're only hearing a few minutes of the beginning of each movement. You can actually tell from the same piece of music.
One of the things that was occurring to me as you began this is that the symphony is written in a minor key, C minor, which was one of his... Whenever he wrote in C minor or E minor, you knew he was going to get heavy and get into his more profound sides. But the last movement that we're going to go into shortly, it's very interesting. I did some looking up on this today. The last movement is in C major. What does that mean? Well, all of a sudden, this kind of mysterioso that you just heard there, the mystery, the sense of questioning, the sense of how are things going to be resolved, however you want to read that, romantically, in terms of life and its struggles, or just, you know, whatever, nature, as he sometimes depicted it. But when there's a transition, one of the most famous transitions in music, like which I guess we'll hear, I don't know, which transitions from the end of what you've just played into the last movement, and the transition is a very... It's a very slow transition that builds up, and then there's this unbelievable outburst of joy in a major key. It shifts keys. And at the time, people said, well, you can't end a symphony that began in C minor. You have to end it in another minor key. And he wrote, I wrote this down here somewhere, his own words were, many assert that every minor piece must end in the major. And he said, nego, in Italian, no, joy follows sorrow, sunshine, rain. And so it's very interesting. You get this kind of mysterious questioning, deeply questioning, worrisome kind of sound we just heard, And then at the end of this movement, there is this kind of this buildup of some, the percussion, and then it explodes.
John, what I'd like to do is play the fourth movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and let it play all the way through to break, and I'd ask our listeners to come back after a short break, and John and I will talk a little more about the Fifth Symphony of Beethoven and move on to the seventh. So this is the Allegro movement, the final movement of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony.
Peggy Stanton, and I'm inviting you to join me on Power from the Pews when I interview the people who are engaged in remarkable ministries that are making a real difference in their parishes and the world. That's this Saturday at 11 a.m. and Sunday at 9:30 a.m. on Ave Maria Radio.
You remember the day you first laid eyes on her. They handed you the keys and you drove back home for everyone to admire. And although the memories have been made, it's time to pass the torch to someone else. Consider donating your vehicle to Ave Maria Radio. Even if it's not running, we'll take care of everything from pickup to your tax receipt. Just call 866-628-CARS to show you just how easy it is to donate. That's 866-628-CARS. And mention Ave Maria Radio.
Pastor Don Piper died January 18, 1989, when a semi-tractor truck crushed his car. Declared dead by the first rescue workers to arrive on the scene, Don's body lay under a tarp for the next 90 minutes. Meanwhile, Don's soul, he maintains, was experiencing love, joy, and life like he had never known before. Don believes he was in heaven. The film 90 Minutes in Heaven is based on the inspiring New York Times best-selling book that has sold 7 million copies. The film is being released on September 11th, but listeners to Ave Maria Radio have an opportunity to see the film ahead of time. On Tuesday, September 1st, Ave Maria Radio is sponsoring a free pre-screening at the Rave Theater on Carpenter Road in Ann Arbor. Once again, that's September 1st, 7 p.m. at the Rave Theater in Ann Arbor. For more information and to register, go to AveMariaRadio.net and click on the 90 Minutes in Heaven banner.
I'm back with John Berenson, and we're discussing another of the great recordings of classical music. And this one is the recording on Deutsche Grammophon from 1974 and 76 of Beethoven's Fifth and Seventh Symphony by Carlos Kleiber, conducting the Vienna Philharmonic. And we just heard, before break, the first minute and a half of the last movement of the Fifth Symphony. And, John, that's a rousing movement. There's a lot of affirmation in that.
You know, if I were a psychologist, and I'm not, although as a clergyman you wander into that, how could that be any more encouraging to a human being, say a human being going through personal problems or struggles, you know, whether they're domestic or struggles of your life or, you know, the struggles on the world stage. I think that's what gives it its great. It's a kind of a companion So no matter what you are going through as a person or your community, it's as if Beethoven understands it and moves you through it and to the other side. I'm really waxing poetic here, but I really
I found myself spontaneously conducting, but of course I do that a lot. But we want to move now, John, to the Seventh Symphony, which just a little anecdote here. The famous Allegretto, the second movement of the symphony, and we'll play it, and I'm sure our listeners will recognize it. It is probably, of all the pieces of classical music, perhaps with the exception of a piece by Schubert, used in films. I can think of three or four films I've watched in the last few years all use this Allegretto movement of the Seventh Symphony. Can you think of a reason for that?
A little fact put for your listeners. At the premiere, the audience, and this was common in the 19th century, demanded to hear it again immediately after it was played. So that movement got repeated on the spot before they moved on at the premiere.
Well,
so it had that impact back then.
Now, the Seventh Symphony, is it different in theme, outlook, intention than the Fifth?
Number one, when you read about the composition of the two and what he went through to compose the two, it's quite clear that the Fifth took him a number of years and went through a lot of rewriting, and he literally struggled. There was a lot of red penciling that went on with the Fifth, and it took him a lot of time to piece it together. One of the great presentations of that was when Leonard Bernstein, back in the late 50s, did his Young People's Concerts with the New York Philharmonic. You get those videos now, and he showed what Beethoven went through to put together the Fifth Symphony. It's very much, it was a very much piecemeal process, and he went away from it, came back to it, went away from it. The Seventh just sort of flowed off his pen in a very short time. It just, the spontaneity of the Seventh, it just came out. The notes just fly off the page. The drama here is less this kind of heroic heroism and more the joy of the dance. It's some people have said it has a kind of, what do they say, Bacchic quality, as if that's the right word from Greek mythology. You know, the
Bacchic frenzy I've seen it described as.
Yeah, and you'll especially hear that at the end of the final movement. But it's there all throughout. There's a sense of. I mean, this is like, I don't want to say it's like some great what are the Romans? It's like a great Roman feast. When it gets out of hand.
It got a little orgy quality to it.
There's an orgy. I've heard that phrase used. There is an orgiastic quality here in a very kind of earthy sense that you don't get in the Fifth. The Fifth is, it's just, you know, this is like no BS. The Fifth is no BS. here is a kind of orgiastic frenzy celebrating. It almost has a kind of a pagan earth quality to it, frankly.
Well, let's have a listen to the opening of the Seventh Symphony, conducted by Carlos Kleiber and the Vienna Philharmonic. Boy, that one starts out with those emphatic chords, emphatic in a certain way, reminiscent of the Fifth Symphony, but then it just takes off very quickly and, in a very affirmative way.
It's a different, see, I don't know what the key is here, what key it was in A major, I don't know what that means. It's in a major key, and it is a bit more.
Yeah, A major.
Yeah, it's more sunny. I mean, it's
more confident. It's like more confident almost.
Right. You know, the troubles are past. We're going to have the festival in the meadows. The big picnic is on, and we're going to dance until the lights go, until the sun goes down. I mean, this is what the Seventh Symphony. The other thing is, it's a lot of people would consider this the most perfectly written of his symphonies.
Yes, and I would tend to agree. And it was the one that brought me into really loving Beethoven in a way that I didn't 20 years ago, this symphony.
I grew up with a recording of the great Bruno Walter, the German conductor, from the late 50s when he was older, and he did a series of recordings for the then Columbia Records, and he recorded what was called the Columbia Symphony, which was kind of a summer version of the New York Philharmonic. And I grew up, I don't know if it's available, it was a great, great, great recording, Bruno Walter. And that's one of the things, I used to listen to that over and over again as a young person when I was a teenager. It just hooked me.
Well, you know, we're going to now listen to the second movement, the famous one we were discussing, and I want to go ahead and start playing that so we can hear a little more of that than some of the other movements. This is the second movement, the famous Allegretto of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. With John Berenson, we're talking about one of the great recordings in the classical repertoire, the Seventh and Fifth Symphonies of Beethoven, recorded on Deutsche Grammophon in the 70s by Carlos Kleiber and the Vienna Philharmonic. What do you think makes that movement so immediately appealing, John?
It's a variation form, and if it's sustained the way Kleiber does, with a kind of continuous, gentle, rocking motion. Again, I'm using romantic language, which probably is not appropriate for a classical piece, but I find myself compelled to do it. There's a piece by Mendelssohn around the same time or a few years later called Calm Sea and Prosperous Voyage.
Yeah, that overture.
Mm-hmm. Yes. This has that kind of sense that we're on the waves and the calmness of the sea, or it has a feeling of journeying here. I think the feeling of journeying is key to this. I'm on this journey. Images come to mind of Lawrence of Arabia making his way across a large stretch of desert, or someone in a caravan, a sense of being in a caravan going on a journey. It's a gentle journey.
I like it for its placidity. There's motion, there's forward movement, but it's very elegant. It's as if this person is well dressed. This person is standing up straight. This person is supremely self-confident.
When I was in high school, early on, I can remember using another Beethoven piece to get me through geometry assignments at night. I struggled with geometry. I got good grades in it, but this was 10th grade. Beethoven's slow movements, what do they call this? The Mozart effect. Some scholars dispute whether this is true, but I swear by it. This is the kind of movement. Another one was the slow movement of the Emperor Concerto, which I used to put on.
Oh, that's gorgeous.
I think it just calmed me down so much that I didn't get hyped up, and therefore I was able to concentrate. But that was my only way to complete geometry assignments, was to listen to the slow movement of the Emperor Concerto. I would say this has that same calming effect. Calming, but not, doesn't make you sleepy, but in a sense of calming, but your awareness becomes sharpened. And it does, I think it's very much, the rhythms are very much a journey type rhythm. You're on some sort of journey somewhere.
By the way, John, while that music was playing, we had discussed how many movies that this particular movement has been used in. I found a list of over 20 films that this music has been used in. Can you imagine?
Well, just name one or two of you, or if you don't have them.
Sure. Well, let me name some that you perhaps, Mr. Holland's Opus, which of course was conductor. Irreversible, which was a very tough Italian film about an assault on a woman. Cop, The Fall, Darjeeling Limited, Tears of April, mm-hmm. Knowing, and for me, one of the great horror films of all time, The Black Cat from 1934 with Bela Lugosi and Boris Karloff.
Mm-hmm.
And then
mm-hmm.
Lola, which was an Alain René movie from 1961, and A Touch of Class, which was, I think, a Glinda Jackson vehicle from the early... And Zardoz with Sean Connery.
Some of that sounds like, I wonder how well masked it is, because some of the films you're naming there and their themes... And their texts, I wonder if it's a different type of, maybe something from Franz Liszt with a demonic quality might have been appropriate there. But it also helps you mark time. I can see how a movie producer or director would like that music, because it tends to, you can have it stretch over certain segments of a drama. I could see the narrative. So it has a narrative, I think there is a narrative quality. And you can just sort of mark time while
it was used in the King's Speech.
Oh, that's probably why I like it so much. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's listen to the opening of the third. Let's not let our time get away from us. Third movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. John, as I listen to that third movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, I feel a little let down after that magnificent Allegretto movement. Is that unfair?
What were you expecting, either emotionally or in contrast?
Well, I mean, we went from this grandeur of that great marching theme of the second movement. I guess I was not expecting to go to pizzicato violins and, you know, I had this vision of mosquitoes, you know, on a summer night buzzing around me.
In the string quartets, which are my favorite works of Beethoven, especially the late quartets, that's my desert island music, there are a number, especially in the late quartets, of very slow, profound, deeply profound, consoling movements, immediately followed by almost folk dances.
Yeah, right.
That's typical of him. He does that. I heard the Juilliard String Quartet this past winter locally, and they played Opus 127. And Opus 135, the so-called last string quartet, even though it wasn't the last piece that he wrote, it's Opus 135, and it ends with a dance after just a profound slow movement, and it ends with a dance, and you feel like you're just skipping down the sidewalk. That's what Beethoven was.
Well, you know, the fourth movement. Another Allegro movement, when it's performed, there is no pause. It goes straight into it. So let's go straight into this fourth movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony. That was the fourth movement of Beethoven's Seventh Symphony, played by Carlos Kleiber and the Vienna Philharmonic. And, John, that movement got me conducting again.
The Richard Wagner made the remark about that movement of the piece, of the whole famous remark, that it's, quote, the apotheosis of the dance. Apparently, you have to be pretty loose to bring it off.
Tightly buttoned English music critic Donald Tovey, he's the one that described this movement as Bacchic fury.
And Thomas Beecham, who's not one of my favorite conductors, spoke about the difficulty of playing it, and he has a remark here I wrote down. What can you do with it? It's like a lot of yaks jumping about. But I think Kleiber also had a very childlike. Sometimes he was childish, I guess, in his personal life, but he had a childlike approach to the music that matched the perfectionism, so he could get inside something in a kind of a second innocence, and that's also what makes Kleiber so original. It's a child discovering something for the first time.
You mentioned listening to string quartets from later on in Beethoven's life. Would you like to sample his great Hammer Clavier Sonata?
Was
one of his last piano compositions.
Nope.
I went ahead and downloaded for you one of your favorite renditions, and this is by Michael Korstick, and this is the famous Fourth Movement. Could you tell our listeners a little bit what to listen for, and why is this considered one of the finest pieces of piano music ever composed?
Also, it's not a pretty piece, except for the slow movement. The slow movement is gorgeous, but the rest of it, Hammerklavier, all it means in German is piano. But to a lot of us, Hammerklavier means Beethoven's pounding a lot, because it can be pounded out and it can be subject to that. Bad pianists will make it sound like a guy just got a hammer. But he did get a little bit more bangy toward the end, you know, as his hearing got bad. But what's extraordinary about the Hammerklavier is the extremes of dynamic contrast, using the far ends of the keyboard, and in this case, a fugue, which people after Bach had a very difficult time doing.
Let's listen before we run out of time. Michael Korstick playing the fourth movement, the final movement of the Hammerklavier Sonata number 29. In the last 30 seconds, tell us what Beethoven was doing here with this late piano sonata.
The late piano sonata, like the late music as a whole, you'll especially hear a lot of trills. I think it's a kind of sense of spiritual reach. He was not an Orthodox religious believer, but there is this sense in the late works that he's kind of like yearning into kind of infinity in a kind of yearning fashion, more than he did when he was younger. You especially hear that with the use of trills. The very final piano sonata, in the whole last movement, is just a set of trills. And it's almost as if he's trying to reach beyond sound itself. And I think that that's what the genius of it is, the yearning one.
John Berenson, thanks for doing Church and Culture again with me. We're going to do some more great recordings in the future. And I hope, if nothing else, we spurred some of our listeners to go and listen to some Beethoven on their own. So all of you who've been listening, please stay with me after this short break. We're going to have another great guest like John Berenson.
Here's a Family Minute with child psychologist Dr. Ray Guarendi from Ave Maria Radio.
Is discipline kind? I feel like I'm nagging you because I've asked that question 5 times. And this is the 5th reason I'm going to give you why discipline is ultimately kind. Routinely, parents will walk into my office and say, "My child has a poor self-image." Why is that? At the basis of many, if not most, of these poor self-images is an undisciplined child. Undisciplined people smack up against the world. They smack up against other people. They create friction with other people. And they realize that other people do not like to be around them. Their peers, maybe a Sunday school teacher, other adults in the family, Even grandma can be pushed to her limit by this child. So what happens to a self-image? It gets battered. It gets bruised. It gets knocked around. Discipline is kind because it teaches a child you have to control your behavior around other people. And ultimately, your self-image will not go into tatters because other people are giving you messages, "We don't like you, son." Discipline is kind. It ultimately leads to a good self-image. I'm Dr. Ray.
This is Lavinia Spirito for Catholic Way Bible Study. The Bible is full of references of the importance of reading God's Word. For example, Paul's letter to the Hebrews says that the Word of God is living and active, sharper than any two-edged sword. Psalm 119 tells us, "God's Word is truly a lamp unto our feet and a light unto our path." And the cry of the Shema Yisrael from Deuteronomy, "And these words that I command to you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children, and you shall talk of them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise." Like the chosen people, God's church is called to read, study, absorb, and apply the entirety of God's written revelation. We can trust the scriptures to reveal God's mind and purpose about our lives and situations. You can trust the Lord. His word is true.
Catholic Way Bible Study. Peace, power, purpose. Find out more at cwbs.org.
Fully Alive. Reflections on the scripture readings of today's Mass with Father Pat Egan, chaplain of Ave Maria Radio.
The second reading this Sunday at Mass is taken from St. Paul's epistle to the Ephesians. It gets really eloquent. A couple's marriage, commitment to each other, becomes a sign of God's love for his church. This is a mystery of faith and a means of grace, by which men and women are led through this life towards our heavenly home. The church teaches that marriage, like the other sacraments, gives grace to overcome sin. We call this conjugal grace. Specifically, this conjugal grace addresses how the fall damaged Adam and Eve. They were damaged individually, but they're also damaged in their relationship with each other. They need a savior for their own personal salvation, and also for deliverance from the evil introduced into their married life as a couple. St. Paul spells out for us how a married man and woman can